Hello, and welcome to the show today. This is your host, John Michael Talbot, and I am here with my guest, Winston Wu, who is the owner of DebunkingSkeptics.com and HappierAbroad.com. He is also an author of several books. And welcome to the show, Winston. How are you doing today?
Oh, I'm great. Thanks for having me, John.
Oh, no problem. I'm very, very happy to have you. I've been a fan of your work. I love your article about how the word skepticism has been hijacked to mean its opposite. And so if you could go into that for a second and kind of talk about why you think that's happening. You know, what is the motivation with these people? Is it a mindset? Is it is it American exceptionalism that makes them defend the establishment constantly, or is it something hardwired in their brains, or are they, you know, paid to do this kind of thing? Why do you think this is happening?
Well, first of all, is my voice coming through okay, or can you hear me okay?
Yeah, I can hear you fine.
Okay, great. Well, I think it's a little bit of everything that you said. I wouldn't call it American exceptionalism. There's just this idea that many people, if not most, have that truth comes from authority, okay? You're not supposed to think for yourself. You're supposed to get your truth from the establishment, the authority. And so there's this fallacious assumption that truth comes from authority, when in reality, truth comes from evidence. It comes from reason and from logic. And so that is part of the brainwashing, and some people are just very closed-minded. They don't like mystery. They don't have an imagination. They can't see the big picture or connect the dots. And so a lot of pseudo-skeptics are just people that are very, very narrow-minded. They believe that there are no mysteries and that basic science and can solve everything, and that everything has a conventional explanation, even if it's if it doesn't have a conventional explanation. I mean, there are so many mysteries and unexplained phenomenon, and some people just can't accept that there's a mystery. So there's that, and also a lot of pseudo-skeptics tend to be atheists who are very left-brained and believe that if God or the metaphysical universe doesn't fit into left-brain logic, then it can't be true. And the problem with that is left-brain logic doesn't explain everything. It does not explain the universe. The universe doesn't follow what, you know, they think. And there's a great, great quote that I love to quote on my site. It's by a French philosopher. I don't remember his name. But it says that every man takes the limit of his vision for the limits of the universe. So we have this assumption, this fallacious assumption that if we can't see something or understand something, that it must not be true. And so I think some skeptics are just closed-minded and narrow-minded, and some are probably shills that are paid by maybe parts of the government or some corporation that likes to defend the establishment. I mean, you see how the mainstream media is controlled, and they always defend the establishment on every issue, even when the establishment...
And that's what I meant about American exceptionalism. I mean, I think some people might defend the establishment just based on that alone, just based on the belief that, America is number one, and so basically anything the government says, they just kind of toe the party line, you know what I mean? But...
That's a fact, but you see a lot of these pseudo-skeptics are atheists, too, and, you know, the most patriotic Americans usually believe in God, you know, and the Founding Fathers believed in God, you know, even Charles Darwin believed in God, and Thomas Paine believed in God, too. I mean, they may not have been Christian fundamentalists, but they believed in God in the general sense, you know, and so, you know, atheism is pretty extreme in that sense. I mean, these people are hateful. You know, they hate religion, and it's a belief system based on hate, and it's just exaggerates too much. That's
interesting, because you have a book debunking Christianity. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's part of my site. I was a former Christian fundamentalist, and but I'm not an atheist. I have similar beliefs to you, that I believe in a God that is in all of us and in the universe, like a source of energy. Like our, you know,
sure, yeah.
Turn on the TV.
Like there's the new book called Biocentrism. I can't remember the scientist's name right offhand, but basically he says that our brains receive quantum information, and it's like a TV.
Your TV
gets the cable signal. Yeah, and you know, but if it gets turned off, you know, the TV is essentially dead, but it's not dead. That signal's still out there somewhere, you know. You know, some people say, oh, that's just an excuse. They just say quantum because they can't understand, you know, it's just a way to just mystify things. But, I mean, we have experiments that show very interesting things. Like they've taken DNA from somebody and taken it 400 miles away and exposed the person to stimuli, and that person's DNA reacts as if it's with the body, like there's a force connecting things, almost like Star Wars, you know. And I'm a big Star Wars fan. I just think that, it might, some people might think it's blasphemy, but in a way, I think we are God. I think I think it's Robert Lanza is the scientist. I could look it up here, but you know, Biocentrism is the book, and. He basically says that you can't have nothing from nothing. You know, there had to be thought first. There had to be life first. That life is what that the universe is tailored for life. And some people will argue the exact opposite. But have you heard of these concepts? And it's starting to become more popular. And a lot of physicists and scientists into quantum mechanics and stuff are talking about it. What are your thoughts on all this?
Oh yes, I've heard about that, and I agree. I think that even though we don't believe in a traditional God, that all of us deep down knows that there's some type of creator or consciousness that created us. You know, so at a very deep level, we all know there's a God, and that's why atheists, they a lot of them seem so angry. It's because they're suppressing this inner knowing of God, and in order to suppress something within yourself, you have to generate a lot of anger and hatred, and that's why their personality.
But could it be that organized religion has been corrupted, and it has been used as a control mechanism, and the prophets that we have, their words have been corrupted and used. I think that's where a lot of the anger comes from, you know. I think a lot of people that were prophets that were connected to, you know, this higher consciousness that we call God, I believe that, you know, religion, organized religion has corrupted those messages, and I think that's maybe what they're rebelling against, you know. Because I have a friend that's an atheist, and when I... What's that?
Yeah, hello? Are you there? You were talking about your atheist?
Yeah, I'm here. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay, yeah, I lost you for a second. You were talking about your atheist friend, you said?
Yeah, when I get to talking to him... more along the lines of, you know, quantum mechanics and, you know, just that there's, like, he doesn't believe in a God that's here, like he posted something today, and it said, like, if I was God, I wouldn't punish somebody for raping a girl. I would stop the girl from being raped. Do you see what I'm saying? But, I we're not saying that there's... that kind of God. I think you would agree there. I just think that we're a meat vessel, basically. That's how Joe Rogan puts it. You know, we're a meat vessel. We are receptors of information, and it's collective consciousness comes into play. That's why people have intuition and it explains all kinds of things, reincarnation, you know, it's energy. And so it leaves a lot, you know, like when you die, it doesn't promise you that there's a heaven. It doesn't promise you that anything. Like he says, you know, there's multiple universes. You could die and go to a different universe, or whatever. It's not like promise that you're going to see your loved ones or go to heaven or anything. It just means that there's life after death. And I think what they are rebelling against is like these very rigid ideas of religion. Do you know what I mean? And so I kind of feel like there's a shift going on. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, I rebelled against religion too, but I didn't become an atheist. I just became a person who believed in God, but not religion, because religion is mostly man-made and with nuggets of spiritual truth. The problem with religion is that it tries to package truth like a fast food, like McDonald's, and truth does not come in a package like fast food. Okay, I mean, truth is a search. Truth has many layers. There are physical layers, non-physical layers, deeper layers that the human mind cannot comprehend. And, you know, I believe, you know, there are many layers of reality, physical and non-physical. And sometimes those realities intersect, which is why there's paranormal phenomenon that can't be explained. And, I do believe in a God with many faces that... And, you know, but religion can be a good thing, too, because it gives people a purpose, something to live for. And I've always believed that God can work through different religions. I mean, not just one religion. And so people can sometimes, you know, attain some spiritual results or spiritual consciousness within any religion, whether it's Buddhism, Islam, Judaism, Zoroastrianism, Shintoism, Hinduism.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of common themes. I mean, the basic common theme is to be a good person and that you'll get rewarded for that.
Well, yeah, there are so many parallel sayings between Jesus and Buddha. I mean, if you the deeper meaning of the sayings are the same thing, you know. It's just that people argue over the semantics and the hyper-literalist interpretation, which I don't think religion is.
And I found this here. It's Dr. Robert Lanza. Now, he wrote this book, and it says, from his bio, it says, U.S. and News World Report cover story, his mentors described him as a genius, a renegade thinker, and even likened him to Einstein. And he basically says that consciousness moves to another universe at death. And, I mean, he talks about multiple worlds. He talks about the soul. And he says, is there an abundance of places or other universes where our soul could migrate after death, according to the theory of neo-biocentrism? But does the soul exist? Is there any scientific theory of consciousness that could accommodate such a claim? And there's another scientist, and he says a near-death experience happens when the quantum information that inhabits the nervous system leaves the body and disperses into the universe. And he says consciousness resides, according to Stewart, this physicist, in the microtubules of the brain cells, which are the primary sites of quantum processing. Upon death, this information is released from the body, meaning that your consciousness goes with it. They have argued that our experience of consciousness is the result of quantum gravity effects in these microtubules, theory, which is dubbed orchestrated objective reduction. And so that's what I was saying, like, you know, these kind of ideas, I have found that atheists are more open to this because it's not a God as we understand a God through organized religion, but, you know, what does this imply? Does this imply that it doesn't matter what we do in the physical world? Does this, you know, do morals have to come from religion? I don't feel like they do. I feel like I have morals anyway, and I feel like it's like equal and opposite reactions, you know, like Einstein talked about, or the Force in Star Wars, yin and yang, you name it, duality, you know. Everything you do has a consequence, and the dark and the light kind of work together. You know, there's Native American concepts that talk about this kind of thing too. So that's what I was saying. I think atheists are, you know, it's becoming more scientific to talk about this today and take kind of religion out of it. But you know, so I haven't read your book about Christianity, but What do you get into with the book there? Like, you debunk Christianity as being taken literally, or, I mean, how does it fit into this whole scheme?
Well, I mean, if you take it literally, Christianity, I mean, you know, it just creates so many problems because there's just so many contradictions and things that don't make sense. And, you know, it's hard to believe that, you know, that God's going to punish everyone who's not a Christian or send them to hell or something, and even if they're good people. I mean, that just doesn't make any sense, you know. I mean, a lot of it makes no sense, and it's like even when I was a Christian.
And see, that's what I'm saying. On the other hand, if you believe the scientific explanations, it's like, well, then Hitler dies and he gets to have his consciousness go into the universe and be fine. You see what I'm saying? And so it almost like I see problems with both sides, but the truth is the truth, whatever it is. But I'm sorry, go ahead, continue.
Yeah, well, I was just saying that, you know, the main problem with religion is not just that it's hard to make sense out of it or reconcile it with reason, but, you know, it also limits you. You know, like, for example, you know, like if I pick up a book on the occult or astrology and I'm a Christian, I'll feel guilty because I was told that that's messing with something satanic, you know. So it limits
sure.
your beliefs, limit your mind from exploring new fields of knowledge. And so I just don't feel like I'm free to do what I want or think what I want because there's so many strict rules in organized religion. And so, you know, you don't have freedom of mind. And, you know, and the universe becomes black and white, you know, like you're either a Christian and you're saved and or your father is Satan, you know, and you're unsaved, you know, and there's just too many black and white dichotomies. And reality is not black and white. Most of reality is shades of gray. So it's just,
right.
You know, I'm a truth seeker at heart, and I've come to realize that religion is not, you know, is not the way to truth. I mean, it's a stepping stone to truth, but it's not the end point of truth.
Sure.
It's not. It doesn't
yeah.
contain the package. And so truth is a constant search. You know, you have to you know, look at every, you know, every religion has some truth and every belief system. And so you have to look at it all and separate the wheat from the chaff and you know, like an eclectic.
Yeah, wheat from
you know,
God. You know what I like about Buddhism is that Buddha said, believe nothing unless it rings true to you, even if I said it. I don't think there's ever been a better religious statement than that. But, the ultimate truth is that we have to figure this out. You know, if we are a collective consciousness, if we are – like there was an episode of Through the Wormhole recently where they debated whether ocean is a living life form. And basically, like, your body has, you know, microorganisms all through it that are doing all kinds of things and living inside of you, billions of them. And your heart's beating, you're not controlling it, you're breathing, you're doing all these processes in the oceans, doing what it does. And they had something that they took and they from the ocean, and they were examining it, and the woman said, you're not going to believe this, it looks like a neural network, like a brain, like it's a conscious being. And so it's like you could think of the universe as like a conscious being. You know, it's like Joe Rogan said, you fly above L.A. and you look down at the cities and they look like mold on bread. It's like, so we think of bacteria as nothing, you know, and it's like, but that's the small scale. And then here we are and there's the universe. And it's like, I just, the oneness idea makes a lot of sense to me. And, you know, I think that
the
savior is us, possibly. Do you know what I mean? We have to save ourselves. We have to figure this out. And like you said, you're a truth seeker. You know what I mean? That's why I bring up ideas of like, well, what does it mean if consciousness is you know, just a signal being received and then it gets released into the universe? Do you? That would mean you could be reincarnated. You could go into a body. You could be lost. You could be. You know, do you get to see your loved ones again? Do you get retribution for the bad things you've done? is there karma? Do you know what I mean? Like, there's all kinds of questions that it raises.
Yeah, I do agree with you about, you know, there's God in everything, and your analogy of, you know, like the ocean and the atoms and the cells. You know, I mean, in your body, there's like of atoms and cells, and you know, each of those cells is like a life form. It functions as an organism. Each of those cells,
yeah.
And you know, and so to the cells in your body, your body is like a god. You know, you're like God, and all your cells are
exactly.
Like, you know, part
exactly.
of God.
Yeah.
So that's just how it is. And so the universe, you know, and what's interesting is if you look inside an atom, it looks just like, you know, like a solar system. There's objects revolving around a nucleus. And so it's like everything is made up of something revolving around each other, from atoms to solar systems to galaxies to perhaps the universe and maybe what's outside the universe. And so it seems like, you know, there's a universe, you know, at a micro level too. And
well, yeah, and I mean, this biocentrism, and it gets into multiverses and alternate worlds. Like, it says multiple worlds. It says this hope-instilling but extremely controversial theory, but Lanza has many unwitting supporters, not just mere mortals who want to live forever, but also some well-known scientists. These are physicists and astrophysicists who tend to agree with existence of parallel worlds and who suggest the possibility of multiple universes. Multiverse is also called multi-universe is a so-called scientific concept which they defend. They believe that no physical laws exist which would prohibit the existence of parallel worlds. And so, you know, this gets into, like, you could be dead right now in a different universe. Like every fork in the road, every decision you make, you know, it splits, you know, you're dead here, you're alive there, and it's like, so it, you know, it brings all kinds of questions to my mind. If your consciousness goes out there, do you only get to experience one of these things, or it's just, you
no,
know, it's
you know,
very mind. It's
I don't know if you know the work of people like Deepak Chopra or not, but what he believes,
is that
you know, we have like a quantum soul soup, which means that your soul is not, you know, right now your soul is localized as a localized consciousness, but you know, before you were born and also, you know, after you die, it goes back into this soup. And so when the person is born, you know, a part of this soup, soul soup, comes into the body. And that's why people can have you know, memories of multiple past lives, some even occurring at the same time, because you
or
might,
like deja
you know,
vu and
have
things
memories
like that,
from,
you know.
Yeah, you might have memories from several different souls, you know, and because, you know, and I think maybe the more complicated you are, the more complex you are, it means that you either have an old soul inside you or you have many multiple souls. And, you know,
and that's an interesting thing. People talk about old souls, and then there's been people that get into spiritual research, and they talk about, like, spiritual beings that are very advanced, and they know how to navigate the spiritual world and try to, you know, project themselves onto film and stuff. And maybe that's true. Maybe what, when we leave this world, it's not, you know, so cut and dry. You have to learn, just like you have to learn here. It's like being a baby, you know. Maybe at some point they learn how to bring that soup together and, you know, bring themselves into one, to where they're not, you know, they're not split into parallel worlds. It sounds like craziness when I'm talking about it. It leaves so many possibilities. Like, what does he say here? He says,
well, it makes sense. I mean, the soul doesn't have to be one unit, you know, like one unit, your soul is one unit and another person's soul is another unit. I mean, it's localized right now, but, you know, in the afterlife, it could just merge into this collective soup, you know, or this big, you know.
Could there be a way, I guess I'm saying, could there be a way that you learn to, like, take the unlocalized soul and become, like, a higher being, like a being. Like, there's people that have reported UFOs, for instance, that are beings of light. They look like huge ships, but they're beings. You know, they can see like a face in it, and maybe they've learned how to take, you know, what was once the soup that was split up and like actually control it, and it's not going into multiverses or things anymore, and they've become like a higher life form. Do you know what I mean? Like it brings all these crazy possibilities into mind, and
Well, yeah, there's this quote.
Yeah, I just
that
think
says,
it's astounding.
Universe is not only crazier than you imagine; it's crazier, it's weirder than you can imagine. You know, I don't know if you heard that.
I'm sorry, you're breaking up there for a second. Can you repeat?
Yeah, I was saying there's this great quote that says, "The universe is not only weirder than you imagine; it's weirder than you can imagine."
Yeah.
So, I mean that's probably true. You know. And truth is stranger than fiction, too. You know, there's a lot of things that will just blow your mind if you knew about it. It's just there's a lot of mind-blowing truths, and there's only so much you can understand. You know, but...
Well,
you know,
let's talk about another mind-blowing truth. Let's talk about UFOs and alien abduction, so it's called. Here's a question I have for you. What do you like you're aware of the Greys, and I'm assuming that you believe that these entities exist. If you've researched, you know, Bud Hopkins and Dr. John Mack, I mean, there's plenty of evidence that this is not just, I'm not saying it couldn't be sleep paralysis and fantasies. That's always possible. I never give anything 100%. But I think there's ample evidence to say that these beings, like Whitley Strieber calls them, visitors, are real. But then you have, you know, are they interdimensional? Are they extraterrestrial? Or are they what we would deem spiritual? What are your views on this?
Well, I'm kind of undecided, but I do believe that they probably exist, and I would say that maybe they're interdimensional, because not everybody sees them. Only certain people see them, so that means that only if you're attuned to certain dimensions or frequencies or wavelengths do you see them.
Now, see, that's interesting. I did an interview with an alien scientist, and he brought that up. But the thing is, there's a book by Bud Hopkins called Sight Unseen, where he brings up that they seem to be able to show themselves or not show themselves to who they want to show themselves to. So it's not a matter of who can see them or not see them. It's who they want to show themselves to. So that could be like cloaking technology or something like that. And, of course, religious people will tell you that it's the Nephilim. It's the fallen angels. You know, that's why they're messing with DNA and all of this. And, you know, they can make some compelling arguments if you start to go down that road.
I was just going to say that, I mean, there's a lot of theories, but one thing, you know, we can say that, you know, is very probable is, I mean, that aliens are not really that far-fetched, because, you know, if you look at the evidence in our history and our DNA and our biology, it looks like humans were hybrids, were created as hybrids of something, because we have primate DNA and we have some unknown DNA. And I don't know if you know this, but 95% of the DNA in your body is junk DNA, and no other animal on Earth has junk DNA. So it looks like we were...
Well, I read a book called The Genesis Race years ago, and...
genetic manipulation.
You know, he makes a case... He believes in microevolution, but not macroevolution. I'm not sure where I'm at with that, but there's definitely gaps. And but what he brings up that's really interesting is that at the same time, basically, you know, relatively speaking, historically speaking, you know, the time frame, all the cultures of the world started to do agriculture at the same time. You know, they start to make rice and corn and all, so that's, and develop all these same skills at the same time. Like, we had a jump. We had a jump from being hunters and gatherers to being more than that. And there seems to be, like, an intervention somewhere. So,
Yeah, or it could be, like, a hundred monkey effect, too, where we're just all connected, and so we learn faster when...
Sure, yeah.
Another, or there could be
exactly.
Extraterrestrial forces guiding our civilization. You don't know, you know. There's evidence of that, too, that we're being guided by other forces, you know, either metaphysical forces or spiritual forces or extraterrestrial forces, it seems like.
And what is spiritual? I mean, what is paranormal? I always say paranormal is just paranormal because we don't know what it is yet. Everything is scientific. Everything is normal. We just don't understand it yet. You know, it's like when people thought the Earth was flat or whatever. I mean, it's we come to understand it, and then it's not paranormal anymore. So it's like I talked to Jeremy about EVPs, electronic voice phenomena, and I've gotten EVPs before. I was a paranormal investigator. I went to a house where there was supposed to be a child they had seen, and I got a child's voice on tape. And it's debatable what it says, but everybody agreed it was a child on tape. And I mean, I literally threw off the headphones listening to it and kind of stared at the carpet for a little bit. I was amazed. You see this stuff on TV, but when it really happens to you, it's like, wow. And so you think, okay, is that a soul of a child? Is it leftover energy? Is it a projection of my own mind? I mean, my people listening are probably thinking, wow, you guys are all over the place. But that's the thing. I mean, that's what true skepticism is, right? You keep an open mind, and you don't decide beforehand what's, you know. And that's the thing. Pseudo-skeptics, they know already everything that's going on. You know, they know there's no ghosts. They know there's no UFOs. They know there's no God. They know, you know, everything is just organic and understood, and we know it all. And I don't know, maybe that gives them a sense of empowerment or something. It still confuses me because it's like, yeah, do I want to believe there's life after death? Sure, but if the evidence doesn't lead me there, that's not where I go. You know what I mean? But it almost seems like they want to believe that we figured out everything, and then when that's it, that's it. And then it's just, I don't know, it's astounding to me. It's
they've made up their minds.
It's hard to get into.
From the beginning, I mean, they never change their minds, it seems.
Does it bother them that they're going to die and that's it? You know, I mean, but again, I mean, if they think that's where the evidence leads, fine. But, I mean, that's why I keep searching. I'm like, I want to make sure. I want to be as positive as I can about everything that I think, you know, so I keep testing my own fear. You brought up in one of your videos, James Randi and all that, they're not skeptics because they do not question their own ideas. If you don't question yourself,
that's not a skeptic.
Yeah.
If you only question what you don't believe in or what you disagree with, then everybody's a skeptic because everybody questions and disbelieves what they don't believe in. You know,
right.
There's nothing special about that.
Nothing at all. I mean, when I first got into 9/11 research, when I first got into 9/11 research, I was convinced no plane hit the Pentagon, and now I'm sure of there. You know, I don't know what you think, but I'm sure that one did. My view of 9/11 has switched from being like kind of black and white to very gray to very nuanced, and it became that way because I continued to research and I found new evidence and I went wherever the evidence led me, and that's what I do with every subject. And I kind of say, like, the truth doesn't care what you think about it. It doesn't give a crap what you think about it. It is what it is. If you don't want to think Bigfoot exists, but he does, it doesn't matter that you think that he doesn't exist. He still does. Do you see what I mean? and it's funny. I get into all these subjects because... Sure.
Yeah. You want to hear something interesting. I met this really eccentric but really brilliant guy in Asia once, this British expat guy who, you know, he was living there. And I talked to him last year. Me and a friend talked to him for many hours, and he had so many deep original ideas, and he's into the conspiracy movement and all this stuff too. And he told me something interesting. He told me that after studying it for a long time, he came to believe that the people who believe that 9/11 was an inside job, they actually live in a different parallel universe than the people that believe in the official story. And so the people that believe it was an inside job are like, they live in a universe that where it was an inside job, and the people that don't, you know, live in a parallel universe where the official story is true. So he believes that he's come to see it as, you know, like we live on different planes of reality. Kind of like, you know, when you're in a video game, you're in a different reality than from one game to the other, and or virtual reality. And so it's like, you know, people are attuned to different wavelengths and planes of reality. That's why someone seems to be in a different world than you, with a different mindset and a totally different frequency, like they're on a different radio frequency. You know, so
yeah, I can understand.
That's kind of a version of the multiverse.
It's kind of an out there concept, but. You know, with 9/11, here's what I would say, is that no matter what plane of reality you're in, there's a few things that are indisputable. 70% of the family members' questions were unanswered, right? That's not acceptable
yeah,
to
yeah.
me. For some reason, that's acceptable to debunkers. The air defense, we know that NORAD lied at least 3 or 4 times, admittedly, and the 9/11 Commission thought about, you know, referring it to
well,
the Department
to
of Justice
down,
for criminal investigation.
It's obvious they were told to stand down. NORAD was told to stand down.
You know, their excuse is that they lied 3 or 4 times to cover for the FAA. That's an odd thing to do. And they did it so horribly that they made themselves look like they were complicit when they were just covering up for the FAA's incompetence. That's basically the official story. The 9/11 Commission said they lied. And they know they lied, and they don't know why what they told them was so far from the truth. And they said it's one of those loose ends that never got tied up. And to me, that's just unacceptable. You know, I mean, my wife is a nurse. She knows with her job there's certain things that even if she's just incompetent to a certain degree, there can be repercussions, legal or criminal. You know, I mean, you can't, it's just, you can't have them commit perjury and know it and just not do anything about it. It's insane. And then, are you familiar with the nanothermite evidence at all for 9/11?
Oh, yeah, of course, yeah. Yeah, I mean, that was published
yeah,
in the Open Physics Journal, yeah.
Yeah, and then
this
Dr. Millett comes along, and he wants to refute he releases a preliminary report, just saying that it's paint, but he refuses to do the ignition test, the test that they say where it ignites, and you can see on video where it ignites, it flashes, and it creates molten iron spheres. They always contend that this is the most important test. He never did it. So Mark Basile, who's working on a new study, I did a fundraiser for it, and we're still trying to raise a little money, but his work's underway. He already released some videos where he had like two paints from his house, and then he had a piece of World Trade Center paint, and he puts them all up to the ignition temperature where you see the red gray chip ignite and create these molten iron spheres, and they do nothing; they just turn black and nothing, and debunkers sit here and proclaim, oh, he debunked it, he said it was paint, you know, when he didn't even finish the study, it was preliminary, and now, as far as I know, it's not even on the internet, and it's funny how they'll just, they'll take an inch and run with it like it's a mile, and,
well, there's a big difference.
So, I mean, you know, does that still, isn't it funny just to have a debate between scientists about whether something's an incendiary or a piece of paint? That, to me, in itself, is just amazing.
Yeah, well, you know, 9/11 is strange because every theory, you know, I mean, there's no one theory that explains all the data. I mean, there's just too many unknowns and discrepancies. But the biggest thing for me is that the debunkers cannot explain the physics of the collapse of the towers or Building 7. You know, because each
that's
of those
true.
Towers,
no
I,
matter what happens with nanothermite
tons.
Or yeah, you still have to deal with the fact that you have what 10 or 15 stories in either case that crushes the rest of the building. I mean, just you know,
yeah, each tower
the building gets
500,000 tons and
up.
It's a lot of resistance.
Yeah, how does how does 10 stories crush 90 more stories or whatever? And, you know, the no Joel, all that. Yeah, the physics remains, and it will always remain. And it doesn't matter what can forensically be proven. Unfortunately, you know, okay, so say it was nanothermite. We have Adrian Monahan who does a FOIA request, and he finds out, like, the Navy warfare, some outlet of the Navy or something. They produce nano aluminum, and they were like one of the biggest producers of nano aluminum. And so he wanted to find out like who bought all this nano aluminum or whatever, which would be one of the ingredients. And then their records don't show anything. So if you can't pin down like where the ingredients came from to make it, then you can't pin down a person. Do you know what I mean? So like lately, I've been talking about NORAD. At least with NORAD, you know, like Kevin Ryan wrote a paper, you know, like here's the case against General Eberhardt, the NORAD commander, and why you think he was complicit. And all it takes is a district attorney to look at that case, to look at that article, and say, I think that's compelling. I'm going to get a grand jury together, so he gets together like 23 people or whatever, and then they look at the evidence and they decide whether it's worthy of criminal charges or not, and then he goes on trial or doesn't. So I've been trying to tell people, you know, take this evidence and send it to lawyers. We just need to find a lawyer who's a district attorney who has the power to do this that has some balls. And that's part of the problem is that there's so many people that know what's going on, but none of us have the power to do anything about it. And I've gotten to the point where it's like I listened to the comedian Doug Stanhoe, and he said, raising awareness is the same as doing nothing. You know, it's like you light a candle for a cancer victim or send a balloon up in the air. It doesn't bring them back. It doesn't change cancer. It doesn't do anything. It just makes you feel better. And so I think ego gets involved a lot. And it's like, so I recently stated, look, if it doesn't have to do with a FOIA request, further scientific research or lawsuits, I'm not interested. You know, it's like, do you get what I'm saying? I mean, it's like there's a whole lot of activism out there that's not really doing anything. Like, we can inform every other idiot in the world about what's going on, but unless any of us have any power, we can't do anything.
Yeah, that's the sad thing is, you know, I mean, we can know all about conspiracies, but I mean, you can't even bring justice to it. But you know, you just have to believe that there's some type of karma out there that, you know, will deliver justice at some point. You know, and that the universe has an accounting system, and that, you know, the guilty.
Yeah, and that's what I was talking about. Does it or does it not? You know, but I mean, if you think about light and dark, I mean, there's a religion, Jediism, you know. Based on Star Wars.
Yeah, and you can.
But you know, Star Wars was he. Yeah, you know, like I have a Native American friend, and she says the dark and the light, they must exist together. It's you, like, for instance, like if you had always lived in a dark room and you had never seen light, you wouldn't know what light was. You know what I mean? You have to have the duality to know. Like, to know right or wrong, you have to have wrong. To know good, you have to have evil. So it's kind of like we live in a duality system, and it's almost like things like that
have to
take place, and that there will be justice at some point. It will equal itself out. That's nice to think, but then living in the real world, you want to see that justice. You want to see it happen, and it's frustrating because, you know, were I a person with the power to do what I could do, like with the JFK thing, we had talked about JFK prior to this a little bit. I think that's what happened with that case with, the Kevin Costner, he portrayed the character. Was that not what he was doing in the movie? Is trying to get a grand jury to agree that, like, Clay Shaw and those individuals should be tried, and then they decided they shouldn't be? I think that's what the case was, but either way, it took balls, it took guts for him to do that, and that kind of individual is a hard individual to find. I mean, that's basically a superhero. That's somebody that has something that most people don't have.
He sacrificed
the drive
his career
to put themselves on the line, to put their – what's that?
He sacrificed a lot in his career and his family to do that. I mean,
sure. sacrifice possibly his life, everything. I mean,
yeah, if everybody
did that,
I mean, things would change, but most people are not like that.
No.
Yeah, most, I mean, yeah, he
was
a
very good
person, for sure.
Yeah.
You know, if it wasn't for him, we wouldn't have the Zapruder film either, because he subpoenaed for it, too.
Right, and it's just like now we have a lot of, like, we have a lot of evidence because of the FOIA releases, international, international study of, international, what the heck are they called? Center for 9/11 Studies or something like that. The point is they got NIST to release a bunch of data. And in this data, there's all kinds of footage. And they found, you know, things indicative of explosive noises at the beginning of the collapses and so on and so forth. And there's one particular clip where there's what appears to be, I don't know, a big piece of red chewing gum right up in the corner of a beam. And it's like they have FBI agents there on the phone looking at it and then zooming in on it. And then the person that made the video said, well, that looks just like Semtex, which is an explosive. And so recently I put out a call. I said, is anybody good with FOIA requests? Like, maybe we can ask the FBI what that was they were looking at. And, you know, if nobody does it, I'll do it myself. I'll probably get stonewalled. They'll probably say, we don't know. We don't know who those agents were, whatever. But, yeah, people need to take the steps to go a little further, you know. It's like preaching to the choir. It doesn't – you have to go a little further. But, I don't know. It's just
you also have to consider that the military probably has a lot of technology that's not known to the public, and they could have used that technology on 9/11 too. You know, you got to consider that too.
Oh, yeah, everything's under consideration. I mean, even nanothermite, that's technology that's, you know, it's like you're talking about, even if it's an igniter, you know, it's like it's a wireless system that ignites other explosives and can be possibly tailored to make the noises quieter, you know. And I'm not a proponent of, like,
yeah, and you got to,
I think nanothermite,
if you connect the dots, you'll see that, you know, the leaseholder of the World Trade Center, Larry Silverstein, actually took out an insurance policy 2 months before 9/11 that covered terrorist acts. So he profited billions of dollars from that, you know. And so, you know, part of it looks like an insurance scam too. So, you know, everything looks really planned and calculated, and you have to follow the money. You know, you follow the money and see.
Yeah, and I've seen debunkers say, oh, well, no, he really didn't make any money. He lost money, this and that. And I haven't looked into it.
Oh, no, he made billions.
But even something like that, it's like, you know, those facts, those need to be taken to, like, you know, well, I mean, the SEC did their investigation. They found nothing. But, I mean, it's just whatever we find, there's got to be somebody in power to look at it.
You see, they were losing money on the World Trade Center because they could not rent out all
the offices. They were, yeah, you're right.
There were many floors that had no offices, so it was a money-losing operation, and they could not clean out the asbestos there either, you know, and they couldn't just destroy it, you know, otherwise they'd lose money. So the only thing they could do is stage a terrorist attack and you know, profit from it. And at the same time,
well, I mean, if it was an insurance thing, though, I mean, what's the? It would have to be, Larry Silverstein in cahoots with the government. Like, it would have to be like a deal. Like, hey, I'm getting insurance money, and you get to attack the Middle East. It would have to be something like that, right? I mean,
yeah, exactly. I mean,
because otherwise, the government would bust his ass. I mean, they would have no reason not to, you know. But then you get people that are like, oh, you know, Larry Silverstein, he's Jewish, and you're just trying to, it's anti-Semitic and this and that. People play all those cards, and it's like, you know, it's like, it wouldn't matter who he was. It wouldn't matter it wouldn't matter if his name was Winston Wu, would it? I mean, the facts are the facts, right? I don't care if his last name's Silverstein or not. It doesn't matter. But the other thing that's interesting with him is that he was asked, like, you said you talked to the fire department commander, and he said the building was going to come down or whatever, and then we watched it come down. But whatever he said. But the point is that the fire department commander that day, they knew who the name of that gentleman was, and then Luke Grinnell. He asked him, like, he says that he says he never talked to you. So who did you talk to? And he just kind of avoided the question, and then he said, like, that, like, one of the antennas came down and it cut through Building 7, and everything he said was just not true. It was, you could obviously just tell from the videotapes that his explanation for what happened is not what happened, and so he's lying. He's lying, and it's like, okay, so why? what other explanation is there? And I ended up talking to a he doesn't want me to talk about this, so I won't say his name, but I talked to a friend of his who told me what a good guy he is, and that, you know, he spent summers with him, and he would never do such a thing, and this and that. And I asked him, well, why does his explanation not match any of the facts? And there was no answer that he gave me. And then he told me, well, there were New York labs, and this was a government official too. He told me there were New York labs that did tests for explosives, and they didn't find any. And I said, well, NIST said they didn't test for any explosives. So what are you talking about? And again, I got no answer. So it's just, it's really been a nightmare exploring it since 2004, since I've looked into it. It's got frustrating. I've almost quit a few times, but that's why I'm at where I'm at now. Is it's like, you know, I'm trying to make FOIA requests. I'm trying to further scientific investigations and or you know, contact lawyers and things like that, because I just don't see any point in informing any. I think most people know. I mean, do you not notice when you talk to people in the street that most people agree there's something wrong with 9/11?
Well, I don't know if it's most, but the number has been rising since 2006, of course. But I think most people feel that something that they were lied to or something, but they just can't do anything about it. But you know, you put this up on the internet, and there's a ton of people, you know, that want to defend the official story too. You know, on you go to any forum and talk about this, you'll see like at least half the people, if not more, want to defend the official story too. You know, they just think it's crazy too. So there's a lot of people that are very closed off from this. That it's just too disturbing for them to deal with. You know.
Yeah, it's hard to tell. I mean, the polls are, you know, yeah, like I said, I mean, whether people think it was an inside job or not, there's been a lot of polls that suggest that a lot of people think something's not right, but they don't know what it is. They don't know how far it goes. But you know how to put how much.
Yeah, some people just think that it's just incompetence, and that, or that they knew about it but they let it happen. You know, but there's just too many unknowns and too many discrepancies, and you know, the official story does not make sense at all. I mean,
well, the point that I've made is
crashed and left no significant debris. You know, that doesn't make any sense. You know,
if we have an investigation who they rule out demolition by doing no forensic tests at all, okay, and then they let NORAD lie and never get an adequate explanation as to why they did that. They leave that as a loose end. And they never get records to show what the intercept times were prior to that, to show whether it was normal or not. They didn't do that. They didn't get any records to say, here's what the intercept times in those, you know, areas of the country were prior to 9/11, and they're not abnormal. They never got any records like that. So they never proved that incompetence made sense. And then you have all the prior knowledge, and we just have to assume that's all just, you know, just incompetence. But then, you know, we have people like David Shippers who said that, you know, he was told the proposed dates the hijackers were already in the country, what the targets were, and that corroborates with family member Patty Casaza, who said that whistleblowers told her the government knew the exact date, the exact targets. And then people say, oh, that's hearsay. And she says, well, yeah, it's hearsay because they wouldn't talk to the commission unless they were subpoenaed, because they were scared of retribution of some sort, you know. And so my point is, when you get an investigation like that, even if it wasn't an inside job, what is to stop an inside job from happening when that's the type of investigation that you get? That makes it important enough.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and people say, oh, you know, there couldn't be a conspiracy because too many people would be in on it. But, you know, there are lots of conspiracies where a lot of people are in on it and won't talk. I mean, people don't understand that most people are not complete, are not angels. They're not 100% honest. Most people, you know, can be corrupted very easily.
Well, here's the thing. The NORAD story, they lied, admittedly, for 2 or 3 years about the timelines until they said, oh, you know, we were lying. Here's the real timeline we were covering for the FAA. So in the entire branch of NORAD lied for like 2 or 3 years to cover for the FAA. Nobody said a word to say, hey, that's not right. So that proves right there that's a lie, or just not saying anything. I mean, omissions are lies, too, if you don't say a word.
Yeah, but I always heard that NORAD intercepted a lot of planes in the 2 years before 9/11. They intercepted a lot of planes.
Yeah, there's the 67 number, but then there's people who dispute things about that. But then the popular mechanic said, okay, everything they were looking for was coming in from outward in. They weren't looking inward out or whatever. So everything they were looking for was coming in. It was like drug smugglers and things like that. So, but then you look at the statistics and, like, the number of planes that were intercepted that were drug smugglers is really low, but yet the number of intercepts is really high. It's in the thousands. And that includes I found some records from Canada where it's like 1,500 or something. So it doesn't make sense. They had to be intercepting planes that were coming inward, and they weren't just looking outward. Their explanation makes no sense. The debunkers would say, well, then you should be able to easily find some cases where you can show that to us. But the thing is, they don't have many cases they talk about them. They have a couple cases they talk about where they might be correct about that, but that's it. You know, the fact of the matter is, when a FOIA request was made about that information, the FAA said, we don't keep that information. And NIST said, we don't have to give it to you because we're a bicontinental organization of Canada and the United States. Therefore, we're not subject to FOIA requests. So the information we're looking for, we cannot get. They will not give it to us. So, again, when that's the kind of investigation you get, when that's the kind of results you get, when they could easily prove their points by releasing certain types of data, but they don't. They could, you know, they could easily release that data and show that these were not abnormal intercept times, and that they were just looking outward, not inward. They could easily do forensic tests. Preliminary tests for conventional explosives are hundreds of dollars. They did nothing.
But they can't.
Nothing.
They can't fail to intercept four airlines in 2 hours. I mean, that's just impossible. And people that have worked for NORAD have come out and said that. You know, in the 9/11 truth movement.
There was a NORAD TAC director that came out. There's Robin Horton, yeah. FAA air traffic controller, who came out and said that. And he dealt with two instances of hijackings before.
Well, there's another NORAD tactical director, Robin, not Robin Gordon. Robin Gordon is the guy that...
That's what I'm talking about, is Robin Horton.
Control.
Yeah,
he worked
for
FAA. But there are other guys that worked for NORAD that have come out and said that there's no way NORAD could fail to intercept four planes. They might fail to intercept one if a lot of bad, unlucky things happen, but not four. I mean, that's just...
Yeah, and I've done quite extensive research on that, and it gets really detailed. There's a lot of times you got to look at and this and that. Like if people go to my website, 911debunkers.blogspot.com, and you just search NORAD stand down in our search bar, I did the research. I mean, you're looking at like the major point is that there was no shoot down order that was ordered by anybody that could give it till after the attacks were over. They were just absent, the president and the secretary of defense. And according to all the records we have, they were the only ones that could do it. There may be records we don't have somewhere, something we can't see that like a NORAD director could do something on their own, but they didn't. The time frame that makes sense for like Flight 93 is like 50 minutes or something, 40 minutes for Flight 77. The point, they had enough time. They had plenty of time. We're not talking 15 minutes here. We're not talking 10 minutes, 5 minutes. They had time. They had time to do something. They had time to at least get that third, that fourth plane, if nothing else. And then some people say they did get the fourth plane. If they did, I guess the argument is, well, they lied about that, so what else are they lying about? But I don't think they did. I just think it means that, you know, it's just...
But they were also doing these war games, too, these war game exercises where the real thing was being simulated. And that was obviously meant to confuse them, the war game exercises. You know, and...
Yeah, and see, Miles Kara from the 9/11 Commission, he argues, oh, no, you know, like... He says, turn that goddamn sim off. He says that the second he said that is when it came on the screen. It didn't happen before that. But there's all these other, you know, it's this real world of exercise. There's all these other statements throughout the day, and you can just hear confusion going on. And so it's just, he can say that they were on it all that he wants, but it just... when you listen to the tapes, it just seems like they were confused. And but
have you seen that movie, Operation Terror?
Yeah, I've seen it. I think it's a little far fetched.
Yeah, it shows you how it might have been planned. You know, it shows you how they might have planned it. Operation Terror. You know, it's very disturbing though, that movie.
Yeah, I think it goes a little far, maybe, but you know, some of it. Possibly. I mean, who knows? But the point is, the president had almost 2 hours to issue a shoot-down order, and he didn't. And their excuse is, oh, well, Dick Cheney ordered a shoot-down order or whatever. Well, Dick Cheney wasn't in the military chain of command. He couldn't do such a thing. Any order that he gave would not be followed. So basically, people have talked about for years, oh, he issued a stand-down order. Well, him issuing a shoot-down order is the same thing as him issuing a stand-down order because he's not in the military chain of command. It's only it went from him. It went from the president to the secretary of defense to the NORAD commander. He was not in the military chain of command. So him issuing an order is the same as me or you issuing an order. Nobody would listen to us. So it was a cover story, and the media kind of caught on to that a little bit but didn't. You know, there was a researcher, Jim D. 3100, on 9/11 Blogger that had been talking about this for years. And then Rob's story, I think, kind of picked it up. But, you know, I don't think they kind of went all the way with what it meant. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And if you believe that there were no planes, maybe, you know, there was nothing to shoot down either. You know, you said you believed in the no-plane theory at first.
No, I don't. So I don't believe that. I mean, I think if anything, I think if anything, the planes were remote controlled. That they were taken up. Like, I believe a hijacking the hijacker scenario makes a lot of sense. That they basically planted because we know they infiltrated Al Qaeda. They infiltrated the highest ranks of Al Qaeda. And we had, like, the American Al-Qaeda, whatever his name was. He came out and he said that, you know, he was in the camps and he was an American and he had converted or whatever. And he said everybody knew about the plan. And but we had people that had infiltrated the camps assets, and they said they heard nothing. You know, they knew nothing of what was going on, and so it's hard to believe that
did you hear the no planers say that a remote control plane would be a very risky way to do this, because if the remote control plane missed the towers and hit the ground instead, you know, that would be very incriminating. So that would not be a very practical way to do this, because it's not easy to hit those towers when you're moving at 400 miles an hour, and it's not even aerodynamically possible too to move at 400 miles an hour at sea level, which is what that plane was clocked at, the second plane. And you know, I don't know if a remote control plane could
Adrian Monahan wrote a paper in the Journal of 9/11 Studies how the maneuvers of the planes are consistent with a remote control plane. But either way, those things are kind of side issues. They really are. I mean, to me, it boils down to what did we know? When did we know it?
And plus, you know, a remote control plane should have crumpled up at least most of it outside the building, not sliced through it like a knife through butter. You know, what you saw in that video looked like a video. It just disappeared like a ghost plane into it. You know, I mean, pieces of it should have crumpled off and fell to the ground, you know, even if it was remote. Because a plane is...
It doesn't matter, though. I mean, it's
the
really...
The frame of the tower was steel, and a plane is aluminum, so aluminum does not penetrate the steel that easily.
It is, but you can have a pumpkin gun, and it can shoot through the steel door of a car with kinetic energy, you know. I mean, it's if the planes are going 500 miles an hour, it's... Like, I did a show on 9/11 Free Fall where we talked about this, and it's... you know, we talked about it, some of this...
Yeah, but
possible,
it didn't even slow down when it moved in. If you see
one of my bloggers did something about the deceleration too, where he says there was deceleration, but I haven't looked into it myself. But
no, there was none
on
that.
You could be right.
Of it sliding in. I mean, that's been analyzed. I mean, there was no deceleration at all. It's completely stopped inside the building and then exploded. I mean, it didn't even come out the other side. Mm. I mean, it just went from 400 miles to zero. In one moment, you know, it just doesn't make any sense, you know. I wrote an article about that. I'd never published it, but I could send it to you, where I summarized the arguments of the no plane theory and the arguments against it. And
yeah, I'll take a look at it. I'll send you some of the material I have too. There's always points of disagreement, but.
There's some good arguments for the no plane theory, but there's some, you know, problems with it too, because, you know, a lot of people saw it too, that, you know, saw the plane with the naked.
I mean, there's amateur video. There's
and if it was a hologram.
Yeah, and then we talked about, is a hologram possible? Yeah, it's possible. But then they, you know,
a hologram can't be projected into thin air, you know. A hologram can't be projected in the air, you know, unless they have
and,
special technology.
And then we have, you know, the sound issue, and then, like, the plane, like, it seems to fit the outline of the plane, you know, the building that seems to basically, you know, it looks like a plane hit it. So, either way, I think those are kind of side issues, you know. I've always just kind of tried to say, look, there was the NORAD stand down is very strong. The prior knowledge evidence is very strong, and the controlled demolition evidence is very strong. So if we just stick with that, you know, if that doesn't get us somewhere, what is?
And did you see that Jane Stanley, that 20 minutes early, she called the Building 7? And, I mean, that's another smoking gun.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, when Jane Stanley called the...
Yeah, I mean, there was a firefighter, too. He said, we were told the building would be brought down or it might come down on its own. And then it was funny because there was an article... where somebody was talking about Jesse Ventura, and they were trying to dismiss what he was saying, and they said, oh, well, I was there with Larry Silverstein. He was on the phone talking about with a demolition company about getting the building blown up, you know, and so basically his explanation for why the building wasn't blown up is that he was on the phone talking to somebody about getting the building blown up. It's ridiculous. Like, you know, it's like, why would he be he could have been on the phone that day, I guess, to talk about, hey, can we bring this building down in a week from now? You know, but he was they're talking about it, and there it comes down just like a demolition the same day. So I don't know. You know, it's just, it's
yeah,
wild.
And,
but,
and you know, there's so many other things. You got to consider that, you know, a professional airline pilot is not going to give the cockpit over to a hijacker either. They're trained never to do that. You know, and
that's
and,
true.
You know,
I mean, there's a four-digit code they can put in, and so I mean, that's
yeah,
a, and that's
they,
where
they,
the hijackers could come in. If they released a gas into the plane or something,
you can't just walk into the cockpit either because the cockpit door is locked. The cockpit door is closed and locked. You can't just walk in like that either. And even if you did, they would not give you control over the plane if you were a hijacker, either. You know, that's never been explained. You know, and you know, and if you've never flown a 757, you can't just fly it immediately. Just sit, jump in, and fly it.
Well, and that's the thing too. I mean, Hani Hanjour, he couldn't fly. I mean, I wrote an article through and through. He couldn't fly. They tried to say maybe, oh, it wasn't him; it was one of these other guys. But he couldn't fly either. I mean, they didn't have the skills possible to do, at least with the Pentagon flight. But yeah, like I said, I mean, there's so many little things. You can point to 100 little things like that, but I mean, like the main issues, the three big ones, then you know, the NORAD stand down, the prior knowledge, and the controlled demolition. That's all you need. I mean, it's and how many of those things have to be right? One. It's just like, you know, it's a guy was talking about how many UFO reports have to be right for there to be UFOs. One. How many Bigfoot reports? One.
Yeah.
You know, if
well,
one
you
of
know,
the
you
points
know,
that it means
the strategy behind disinformation is to make it look like anything is possible, so nothing is knowable. You know, it confuses everybody. You know, that's to confuse people, to make it look like there's so many possibilities, including aliens and this and that, so that nothing is knowable. And that's part of disinformation strategy is to, you know, create so many possibilities that nobody can know anything, and so the issue goes away because people speculate on it forever. That's part of disinformation strategy, you know.
Sure, yeah.
You know, if they mix lies with lies
exactly
and truth so that people get confused.
There's been a lot of time wasted on a lot of little things when I think there's like three main issues that we could focus on, you know. So that's why I've tried to maintain that focus. I've tried to say, look, there's three things that prove this case, and you know, let's just.
But the bottom line is, it's got to be an inside job of some point, of some sort. You know, the only question is how it was carried out. I mean, that's the mystery of how it was carried out. But that it was an inside job seems very obvious. I mean, that seems to be the bottom line point. You know, but I mean, it's not that surprising because, I mean, I don't think you know any intelligent person assumed that the government was some honest angel anyway. You know, it's not like the government is honest and clean anyways. I mean, it's always been corrupt to some degree. So it's not a big surprise, you know, that, you know, something like that would be an insane.
And I mean, even hijackers being involved, it's like, you know, you can plant plots amongst them. You can hijack the plot that you've planted amongst them. They could, you know, so it's like one person put it, Vanderloo or whatever, who burnt down the Reichstag. He didn't really burn down the Reichstag, but by the time it was over, they convinced the patsy that he had done it. You know what I mean? So it's like, you know, how good for them to make them think that they've accomplished something they haven't. I mean, Bin Laden, he made a statement like, you know, we expected the tops of the building to fall off, but we didn't think they would collapse all the way. And he was like a structural engineer. So, you know, it's possible that they carried out parts of it and then the government amplified the rest and just made it worse. Do you know what I mean? I mean, so that's kind of the stance I've always taken, is that it's not black or white. If Bin Laden and cohorts were involved, it doesn't mean that intelligence agencies weren't involved, that they weren't pulling the strings and letting them succeed and then amplifying their results. So it's not a black and white
thing
either.
Oh, yeah, that's a possibility too.
But now I know you talk about, like, to switch gears, but you talk about near-death experiences. And I know you've had some debates on your Debunking Skeptics site about that. What intrigues me is shared death experiences. What do you know about that?
I'm sorry, can you... I can't hear you. Your voice is breaking up.
Shared death experiences where... Can you hear me?
Yeah, now I can hear you.
Hello?
I lost you for a minute then.
Have you heard of shared death experiences?
Yeah, I've studied...
Hello?
Yeah. Yeah, what were you saying?
Not NDEs, but shared death experiences where people in the room actually see, beings and tunnels of light and things like that along with the dying person. This is one of Raymond Moody's last books that he wrote was about this. Have you heard of this?
Not really. I might have a little bit, but not really. I think that's a new thing. I mean... I only read Ray
Moody's
original book
in
1975, Life After Life, but I haven't heard of that one, mm-hmm. No.
Yeah, this is interesting because it's like he says that medical professionals, they didn't used to let family members in the room when the person was dying, and since that, that's changed, since that protocol has changed, that these cases started to pop up where it wasn't just the dying person that was seeing these things that people would attribute to lack of oxygen to the brain or whatever, but they were actually, the family members were seeing life reviews and, beams and tunnels of light and things like that. And there doesn't seem to be any good explanation for it except that everybody that's telling it is a lie. And it's just one of those things. My friend said, well, is there any peer-reviewed studies on it? And I said, well, how can you do a peer-reviewed study on something like that? It's like people experience it, and how could they possibly prove it, So I didn't know if you knew anything about that or not.
No, but there's a lot of NDE literature and research that is really interesting, But it's just sketchy because... Mm-hmm. It's inconsistent, and there's so many arguments on both sides that it's hard to draw any firm conclusions on it,
Yeah, I would agree. I think the shared death experience is the one thing that kind of transcends that. That especially something you should look into is the shared death experience. It was one of Raymond Moody's, I think it's the last book that he wrote. I know he wrote Life After Life, and then... I think this is called Glimpses into Eternity or something like that, his last book that he wrote. Is there anything else you want to get into? Are you into cryptozoology at all? I mean, you looked into Bigfoot, anything like that?
Just briefly, a little bit here and there. I mean, I haven't studied a whole lot about it. I think it's kind of iffy. Without physical evidence, mm-hmm. It's kind of iffy,
mm-hmm.
And also without a clear photo or video of Bigfoot or the Jersey Devil or the Loch Ness Monster.
The only one I really put credence into is Bigfoot. I do think there's some very interesting videos. There's DNA evidence, too, but it's not – we don't have a genome. We just have – we'll have, unknown primate or, we can't match it to any known animal, but it's not a whole genome or anything like that.
If Bigfoot exists, it must be an amazing creature to evade capture that so well.
Surely, yeah. Mm-hmm. But
I don't know. Some people think it's an interdimensional creature.
Of course, the Native Americans have always thought it was a spiritual creature, that would explain a lot of things. Of course, when I talk to Stan Gordon, he associates it with a lot of UFO cases. But there's a lot of evidence that suggests it's something biological, I would say more than not. But you know, there's I put an article together where it talks about just all the primates that have been discovered over the last 12 years or last decade or so. And it's a ton. I mean, there's all these like they found 100 orangutans they didn't know about, and I forget 150 mountain gorillas they didn't know about, and all these different subspecies and new species of primates. And it's like you said, we think we know everything, but we don't. There's still a whole lot of life.
Well, the ancient astronaut theorists say that those primates and the Neanderthal and the Cro-Magnon, they were like failed experiments to hybrid, you know, the Anunnaki and mm-hmm. the primates, you know. And the Anunnaki were those people, I mean, those beings were that the Sumerians said that they came from the sky and created humans by merging the DNA of themselves with primates to create like a slave labor force. And
sure.
I don't know if you're familiar with that theory or not.
Yeah, Zachariah Sitchin and all that, yeah. Yeah, I've heard say that his interpretations aren't correct. I don't know. What's his time frame like with Planet X and that whole thing? When would we know if he was correct or not? When's that supposed to roll around?
Well, some people say, you know, it was going to happen in 2012, and then other people say, oh, it's not for another, you know, few hundred years, and other people say, oh, it's not for another 1,000 years. So, I mean, everybody has a different theory on that. But
yeah.
I just find it improbable that a planet would be that far out into orbit, you know, in space.
Right.
You know, wouldn't it just – I mean, how can the sun hold a planet that far out? I mean, wouldn't it just float away? I mean – just doesn't
right.
It seems a bit odd, and plus, you know, how would they people survive without being near the sun either? I mean, you know,
yeah.
The planet would be frozen if it was that far out. So,
mm-hmm.
you know, unless it has some atmosphere.
Well, I think they talk about a binary system, like maybe we have two suns or something like that, and there's one that's hidden somehow, but, you know.
Oh, yeah, there's a theory
it's
that
it's one of those things.
Jupiter
it's interesting, but I don't.
Was the sun,
know,
another sun.
But,
that Jupiter or Saturn used to be a sun, and that we used to have
yeah.
two stars. And some people think George Lucas was whistleblowing that in Star Wars. You remember when in the first Star Wars movie, when Luke Skywalker looked at the horizon?
That's very interesting
and there
were
two
to me
suns.
Because Lucas seems to have, he's a very smart fellow. He put so much into those movies that, you know, there's been times where I've sat there and thought, you know, Was he trying to tell us something with a lot of this? You know, I mean, I think that's how the whole Jediism religion got started. I mean, I know he looked into all the religions of the world, different philosophies, and, you know, and trying to incorporate things into there. But, you know, it's like even when it comes to a Chewbacca, there's been images taken of supposedly a Bigfoot up close, and it looks like Chewbacca, and people go, oh, it's a Chewbacca mask that's been modified. But then you look into some Bigfoot reports, and there's all kinds of people that say, well, it looked like Chewbacca from Star Wars. And I've sat there and wondered, well, did he maybe talk to some witnesses, and that's how they described it, and then he made it that way? He's apparently an interesting character. Like I think it was Seth Rogen that talked to him, and he had all these theories about, you know, like I don't know, there was going to be all these earthquakes and California would fall off into the ocean, and you needed to be at this place and that place. But he's definitely a deep thinker. He's not just a you know, and there's a lot of political stuff in the Star Wars movies. I have a blog actually about Star Wars.
The last movie, Revenge of the Sith, I mean, it describes exactly the false flags, you know, and how a republic
exactly,
becomes
yeah.
an empire, which is what happens to America.
Mm-hmm.
It starts out as a republic and then mm-hmm. becomes an empire and you know, becomes tyrannical. And you
yeah,
know,
and he said, like, oh, no, that had nothing to do with what's going on now, and I don't believe that. Cause it's like, oh, this is how democracy dies, with the thunderous applause, and you're either with me or you're against me. And it was
exactly
like what George Bush said. You know? So.
And the Death
yeah,
Star looks like a moon too. It looks like a like our moon, the Death Star.
It does.
And
then
you know
there's
some
people
that
say there's the hollow moon theory and that all, you know.
Yeah, David
all that
thinks
kind of stuff,
that
yeah.
the Death Star, the moon is like a space station. So he thinks.
Right,
Lucas
right.
Whistleblowing that too, and
And then what was that?
Moon is not supposed to be there. Yeah.
Buzz Aldrin was supposedly, or was it? It was one. I don't know if it was Buzz or if it was one of the other guys, but he was overheard at a party saying that they were warned off the moon and that they had ships that were. It's in Timothy Good's book, Above Top Secret, where he talks about that. The woman that overheard the conversation apparently approached him and said, "Is this true? You know, did you guys encounter aliens on the moon?" And he confirmed the story to her, and she, you know, to her dying day, stuck to the story that that's what he told her, that basically they were warned to stay away. So it's one of those things. It's like, I don't know, but could it be? Certainly, you know, my mind's open. But not so open that I'll let it fall out, as the skeptics would say. So
yeah, that's what they would say, all right.
Yeah, for sure. A lot of
movies do seem to be whistleblowing things. Yeah, I don't know if you saw V for Vendetta, but in it, Natalie Portman said that her dad used to tell her that artists use lies to tell the truth and that politicians use lies to cover up the truth. So when she said that artists use lies to tell the truth, she might have been telling us that in movies, a lot of, you know, people a lot of movies are whistleblowing certain truths to us, and so the artists that make these movies use fiction to tell us truths. And
yeah, it's funny, you know, just on a personal note, I've often got that feeling that sometimes I'm watching a movie, and it's not just a movie, it's more like a history story that's hidden for you. And that's just kind of my own weird thing. There's been times.
Yeah, and you gotta wonder if the director is in on it, or if they're just channeling something metaphysical that's telling us something. If you know how an artist paints something.
But yeah, there's people that wonder, like,
feel like,
a force. I know a girl who believes that Yoda is real and that he was the muse for Star Wars. You know what I mean? That he actually gave this story to George Lucas, and it's like, you know, it's like,
the movie,
maybe, you know, but like, there's the movie John Carter, and it talks about,
John Carter,
you know, like, there's life on,
I think I saw part of that,
on Mars and stargates and that kind of thing. And it takes place during the Civil War, and that's during the time that we had these airships coming to America, where there was people, you know, that came out and looked like humans. And in the movie, she's like, "Oh, so you have ships that sail on the ocean? You know, we have ships that sail on in the sky. You know, that must be amazing." And it's like, the people that made the movie had to have known about these stories, or, you know, something. It's like a It's interesting. You think about it, and there were people at the time, you know, they're looking at Mars and they see canals, and they think they, you know, waterways and stuff like that. And it's like Mars might have had an atmosphere at some time, and then it lost it, and you know, maybe that's where, you know, the whole Richard Hoagland and all that stuff. I don't know. A lot of that looks like BS to me. But then you wonder. It's like, maybe Mars is where we came from, and that we actually migrated from here to there, you know, or from there to here. So it's all interesting stuff. So I know you have this other site. It's about what is it? It's Happier Abroad. You know, I had spoke to you about how I think this country's been in decline for a long time. And so could you just speak to that for a little bit about American culture and how you just think we're kind of we don't realize how stifled we are compared to other countries, and that we could be much happier elsewhere?
Well, yeah, I mean, gosh, I could talk for hours about that, but basically, yeah, I do run a movement that promotes the idea that if you're unhappy or a misfit in America, then you can go overseas to other countries and have a better life. And the conspiracy movement never talks about this, and neither does the New Age. I mean, this is not really talked about, but right now there's like, you know, maybe five million Americans that live overseas, and, you know, they know that, but it's not talked about. And the thing is, I didn't know about this until I started going to Europe and to Russia and to Asia. What I realized was that in other countries, I mean, things are just more natural. People are more down to earth, and they're more relaxed, and there's this feeling of social connection with other people, okay? And you don't get that in America. It's like, I mean, back in the 60s and 70s, you might have had some social connection because neighbors would talk to each other and invite each other over for barbecues and stuff. But nowadays, it's like everyone's disconnected, and there's this cold hostility toward each other. And, you know, I'll give you an example, you know, like when I was in Russia or Europe, you know, I could be by myself and walk into a restaurant, and people would talk to me because there was no fear or paranoia towards strangers. You know, people were very social, very open and engaging. And so the social scene just felt so fluid and natural. And, you know, and if you walk into a restaurant by yourself in America, I mean, people are not going to talk to you. You're just a stranger. You're just going to be invisible. And people are very paranoid of strangers in America. And it wasn't always like this, but people have just become more and more cold and unfriendly. And I think that started sometime in the
1980s. I mean, it's less like that in smaller towns, but definitely in bigger cities. And
Sure. I've noticed that too. But,
like I told you, I mean, even me expressing my discontent with America on Facebook, I get paranoid that, like, the NSA is watching me. And so it's like, do you think that it's is it because America is becoming a police state, or is a police state, or is it something else, something cultural? Or
I think it's a combination of things. I mean, all countries have governments that sometimes – you know, are intrusive and that are corrupt, you know, but, you know, it's not just the government. I mean, no government official comes to my door and tells me what to do, you know. It's just this feeling that, you know, there's this very negative, toxic vibe in America in the social atmosphere, and you can feel it in the energy field that people are just tense and angry and disconnected, and it's like people are not as human as they used to be. You know, and there's so much political correctness that you can't even say or think what you feel anymore. You know, back in the 60s or 70s, people would say exactly what they thought, whether it was negative or not. You know, there was no political correctness. I mean, it wasn't as strict as it is now. And the thing is, in other countries, I mean, people are just a lot more down to earth, and you feel a lot more freer. You know, and also in most countries, the cost of living is much cheaper. So in America, everything's too expensive, so you have to work a lot more. And as you know, if you have a lot of money, you can buy your freedom, you can buy free time. But if everything's so expensive like it is in America, it's hard to buy your freedom, even if you're middle class, you know, whereas you could take that
same
money.
That's something interesting that I talked about, because you also talk about how people should monetize their passions. Can you talk about that for a second? Because you have an article about how to escape.
Oh,
go ahead.
It's about self-employment, you know. I mean, like, you know, you take what you love and you try to make it into a living, you know, and that's – everyone wants to do what they love for a living, I'm sure. But, I mean, it's not always easy, especially if you work a real job. But you have to think outside the box and you know, go your own way, you know. And – you know, and you can, you know, you can make a living online nowadays if you have a good website that offers something and gets a lot of traffic, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I make my living online, too, from, you know, this website, Happier Abroad, and it's really taken off. I have a lot of people, a lot of traffic, and a lot of people posting in the forums and the blogs and a lot of advertisers.
So you have your ad revenue, and then you sell your books on it's pretty easy to publish a book on Amazon these days and things like that, I'd imagine. I've thought about doing it. I haven't done it, but pretty easy process, is it?
You can self-publish a book on Amazon now. Like, you know, not just an e-book. If you want to publish a paperback, you can go to Amazon's subsidiary called createspace.com. And if you go to CreateSpace, you can set it up where your book is a print-on-demand. And so they don't even have to print copies of your book. If somebody orders it, they print it out for them.
Right.
You know,
yeah,
and
just
they
when
take
they
a
want
big,
it, yeah.
They take a big commission, of course. But, I mean, Amazon has a lot of exposure, but, I mean, you're still not going to get the exposure you would if you had a major publisher publish your book and put it in bookstores. I mean, you're not going
to
get that kind
of... Well, yeah, I mean, I've talked to people who've had major publishers, and they said they make like a dollar per book anyway. So it's not, I mean... There's probably not much difference, really.
Really, yeah. But yeah, I mean, anybody could self-publish nowadays. You just have to have a book that's good enough, you know, to get traffic, you know. And, you know, if you follow your heart and just put your stuff out there, you know, the universe will make something out of it, you know. I mean, I'm not even good in business. I'm not an entrepreneur, you know. But I did what I felt was right and what I was passionate about. And the universe rewarded me for it. You know, sometimes if you follow your calling, you know, you'll get rewarded if you follow your calling, you know, and the universe might
reward. Yeah, it's funny. I just posted something the other day. It said, activism is me paying my rent for being on this planet. You know, and...
I make
money for my websites and different things. And
you can also find people that you can partner
with.
You know, like you also find people to partner with. You know, like you and I could partner up and do something on SkepCop. You know, and that would benefit both of us and get both of us some publicity. And
right.
Hello.
Yeah, I'm here.
Yeah, like
I'm
you
here.
And I could be. Partner on some projects, you know, for my SkepCop site or something, and you know, it would be a win-win situation because you would get something out of it, and so would I. It's so you know, there's all these ways you can make a living. You know, you partner with people that help you or that you can help them. The thing is, you have to think outside the box to do this kind of thing. If you're somebody that just needs to be told what to do, you know, you're not going to be good at self-employment. You know, most people are raised in the school system to follow, to be followers. You know, they need somebody to tell them what to do, and so they don't think outside the box, and they're not going to make it in self-employment. But you know, either way, I mean, I was going to tell you that if you move overseas, like for example, you go to Thailand, okay. You know, you can rent a nice apartment in Thailand for like $100 or $200 a month, and you can get good quality food on the streets at you know, cafes or street vendors for like $1 a plate, $1 a dish. You know, if you go to a Thai restaurant in America and you order pad Thai, for example, it'll cost like $9 or $10 here, you know, and which is really expensive. Over in Thailand, you could get that for $1, you know. So you can live a lot more freely with the money you have in other countries than you can here. So to me, that's a better life, more freedom, more time, and the food is better quality. It's not as it doesn't have the bad chemicals that U.S. food has, which makes people fat.
Sure.
So food is healthier, and people in other countries like Asia are very skinny. In Eastern Europe, you know, people are very skinny, too, are very
skinny. And live long lives, too, yeah.
Yeah, even in England, people live longer lives than in America. America is just a very sick country, not only in terms of mental health, but physical health, too, and mental health. And the World Health Organization even said in their article that if you grow up in America, there's a 50% chance you'll develop some type of mental disorder in your lifetime. So even the World Health Organization admitted that. America has the highest rate of mental illness, the highest rate of incarceration.
If they're admitting that, it's probably much worse.
There's the highest rate of incarceration, 2 million in jail, highest rate of depression, highest rate of obesity, highest rate of cancer, highest rate of heart disease, highest rate of diabetes, highest rate of mental illness, depression. So, you know, the U.S. is...
Of course, I got to say, there's a movie called Cancer Curable Now that's on YouTube that everybody should watch.
Yeah, and the highest rate of medical bankruptcy, too, you know. Medical bankruptcy.
Yeah.
You should see this Michael Moore film called Sicko, where he compares healthcare in America versus other countries, and it really makes you mad how in other countries people don't have to go bankrupt from hospital bills, but in America you do.
Right.
People go bankrupt from hospital bills, and in other countries you don't have to because it's covered. So a lot of other cultures have a saner society that makes more sense, which is whereas in America the society is insane. It doesn't make sense, and and people are just way too business-like and robotic. Like, for example, you go out.
I mean, we have, like Jesse Ventura says, we have gangs in our government. We have Democrats and Republicans. I mean, the two-party system has to go if we have any chance at anything. We have to have people that vote just on the person. And but the thing is, I mean, it seems like just such a lofty goal, just like with the 9/11 investigation and everything. It just seems like it's so downhill. I don't mean to be a downer, but it's, you know, hey, if people have to leave to make their point, then, you know, maybe that's the best kind of action.
Yeah, if you think about it, makes sense, because if America is a sinking ship, you know, if you're on a sinking ship, the most obvious solution is to get off the sinking ship, you know. But for some reason, people in America, you know, who are on a sinking ship just complain about it, but they never consider getting off the sinking ship, you know. Like, if you were on a Titanic and it was going down, wouldn't you want to get off of it? Of course. That would be your...
Yeah, I'd want a life raft. I'd want to give it a try, yeah.
Yeah, but when you're in a nation that's sinking, you know, like, it's sinking the way the Roman Empire did and the way the Greek Empire did. When it's sinking, you know, the most logical solution is to get out, but people don't think that that's a possibility for some reason, because this option is not publicized. It's, you know, like if you listen to Alex Jones, it's like he assumes that no matter how bad things get in America, you can never leave the country. You know, it's not an option. It's not a solution. It's not even a possibility. It just doesn't exist. That's his assumption.
Yeah.
But that's not true, because a lot of people do get out of America and are happy. I mean, if you go to Asia and talk to the
I mean, he wants to save it, but, you know, I mean...
Yeah, I mean,
maybe the way to save the ship is to, you know, lose some weight off the ship so it can still float. I don't know. You know what I mean? I mean,
it doesn't accomplish anything to stay on the ship and complain and moan like Alex Jones does and rant about how bad everything is. I mean, it doesn't create happiness. It doesn't create freedom. It doesn't create, you know, the feeling of love or social connection with other people. Like I was just about to tell you that, you know, you go out in public in America, especially in Philadelphia, you know, which I know is a very unfriendly town. You go out in public in America and you look around you, you see that people don't talk to strangers unless it's business related, for example. You know, if there's no business to talk to a stranger, they're just going to ignore you. And that's not true in other countries. I mean, if you went to another country and you saw another American, that American would be a lot friendlier to talk to you than they would be if you were in America. So, for example, you know, I spent a lot of time in Moscow, Russia. You know, and I saw American, you know, tourists and expats there. But every time I saw them, they would be friendly and talk to me and social, you know, whereas they wouldn't do that in the U.S. because it feels awkward and weird to talk to a stranger, you know, unless you have some business.
Well, I know I had a time when I was in the hospital and I was – out of town, out of my element, house sitting for somebody, and I was told that I would be able to get a ride home, and I wasn't able to get one, and just asking people, you know, can I give you $10 to give me, you know, a ride 15 minutes down the road, nobody would want to talk to me. They just didn't want to talk to me. like everybody thought I was going to kill them, you know.
Yeah, there's this coldness toward people. People were not like that in the 1970s. I mean, a lot of older people have told me that people were much more willing to pick up a hitchhiker in the 70s than today. They were a lot more open towards strangers. And something happened in the 1980s that changed the social culture in America. People became a lot less friendly during that decade. I don't know if you remember that decade or how old you are in the 80s.
I grew up during that materialism. That's all I know. I mean, you know.
Well, yeah, there was materialism, greed, and inflation went up a lot in the 80s. But people became more mean, you know. For example, if you compare 1980 to 1989, I mean, America changed a lot. People became a lot more like snappy and sneering and biting and just a lot more cold and angry, like cold-hearted. You know, there was this coldness toward other people. And, you know, but you always get that plastic American smile on the outside. You get the plastic smile on the exterior, but it's very superficial and fake. But but it just started in the 80s. And when I went over to Russia, for example, it was the exact opposite. Nobody had a fake smile. Everyone was more genuine and told it like it is, and there was no political correctness.
I mean, it's so funny. Russia Today, RT America, they're one of the best news networks there is today. They used to be our biggest enemy, and it's like, you know, I had a friend tell me the other day, I said, I don't really like your comment you made on here. You care if I delete it off Facebook? And he said, oh, we don't live in Russia. And I'm like, really? Like, you know, it's like, have you seen RT News? Like, I mean, yeah, you do live in Russia, dude.
Yeah.
Like, it's
well, I think RT News is partly owned by America and Russia. You know, it's partly owned by
America. Yeah, it is. But,
America.
You know, it's they have an American branch, but it's just, it's you know, I
you know, and I don't
think
most
getting
of
more
the newscasters are Russian. But
no, I mean, they have RT America, so I'm pretty sure they have a branch that's just Russian. But I mean, it's just, to me, it's just funny. It's like, you know, they've been through the ringer. It's just like Germany, like 80% of the people in Germany or something believe 9/11 was an inside job. Why
well,
do you think
that is?
Well,
you know, I'll send you some links to some videos I took in Russia, and you'll see how open people are about talking to strangers. Like, I go into a McDonald's or a restaurant all by myself, and you know, young women will ask me to sit with them and talk to them, and you know, they're very flirtatious, they're very open, they're very passionate. There's no fear of strangers in Russia at all. I mean, everyone is just so open and so.
That's what I mean. Like, countries that have been through hard times, like America are going through now, they get better. You know what I mean? So, I mean, it's
in former communist countries seem more friendly, you know, because you know, they're not individualistic. They see, you know, they're more like they like to connect with other people, you know, like in a poor country like Cuba or Mexico, okay, people, you know, are poor, but you know, they develop really good social relationships with other people, you know, whereas America is like, you know, like it's a consumerist society where people don't develop connections with other people. They just
pull yourself up by your bootstraps, and you know,
all business. Yeah, and so, you know, one of the problems of being in America is it's not just lonely and isolating, but if you lose everything, you know, and go bankrupt and everything goes south, you know, nobody's going to help you in America. You know, usually for most people, nobody's going to help them if they lose everything. You know, but in other countries, if everything goes south and then people lose everything, you know, they have a social network and they have a family network that will help them and take them in and try to help them. So there's, you know, people help each other when they're down, you know, whereas in America, you're on your own. If you lose everything, then nobody cares, you know. There's just, you know.
Yeah.
It's just much more of a low.
Canada's right above me, so we'll see. If I can get my wife to change her nursing license to Canada one day, I will try to go north. But
the bottom line is
it's a very
America is a good place. The bottom line is that America is a good place if you want to make money, okay, for a business opportunity, or if you want to see beautiful national parks, because we have the best nature in America. But if you like stuff like culture, soul, if you want a good social life and good relationships with, you know, humble people that are humble and down to earth and authentic, you know, other cultures are much better for social relationships and social life, social connection, having fun.
I don't know how much you think this relates, but I like the rapper Immortal Technique, and he says, "America is a beautiful girl. She's just got a bad attitude." So.
Well, exactly. I mean, people have bad attitudes nowadays, and they're not humble. There's no humility or modesty or meekness in America. I mean, if you go to other countries, even to Canada, for example, you'll see that people are more humble and more down-to-earth in comparison to America. I mean, they don't act as arrogant or pompous or brag all the time like Americans do. So people, so if you're a down-to-earth guy, this is good news, because if you're down-to-earth, you know, in America, you don't really fit into the culture, because the culture, the social culture is not down-to-earth. It's very fake. It's very pompous.
Right.
You know, it's all about illusion and hype. And so a down-to-earth person feels withdrawn and intimidated by American social culture. But, you know, a person that's down-to-earth, you know, will have a much happier time overseas, because in other countries' cultures, I mean, in foreign countries, the culture and the people are a lot more down to earth. And so someone that's down to earth, like me, for example, I'm very down to earth. I would have a much better time in other countries, because it's so much easier to connect with people, even young people. You know, like when I first went to Russia, I could talk to young girls who were 20 years old or 19 years old about philosophy, history, you know, about very down to earth, serious subjects, you know, whereas you can't do that in America. You can't talk to you know, 20-year-old girls about deep topics, you know, but you can in Europe and in Russia,
mm-hmm.
because being down to earth is normal there. You fit in if you're down to earth. You can connect with people. But if you're down to earth in America, the only people in America that are down to earth are senior citizens and older people, you know, but the younger crowd is not going to be down to earth in America. And you know,
yeah.
You know, we don't, you know, the only people that are down to earth are older people, seniors, you know, elderly people are down to earth in America, but that's not true in other countries. In other countries, young people are down to earth, not just old people. Okay, that's the big difference.
Yeah.
And, you know, and if you're a nice, normal guy, you're kind of invisible in America. You know, you have to be a bad boy, or you have to be very wealthy and have high status to be noticed.
Yeah.
Either that or you're a bad boy, you know. In Russia, it's the opposite. If you're a bad boy, you know, there's a lot of bad boys there. It's nothing special. But if you're a nice guy that treats women really good, then you stand out. The women see you as refreshing and new and interesting.
That's interesting. I don't know if you like hip-hop music, rap music at all, but there's a movie called Thug Angel about Tupac, and he said that when he was younger, he tried to be really respectful to a woman, and you know, you're beautiful, and you're this and that, and trying to be so nice to her. And she said, this will never work because you're too nice. And it just kind of ruined his image of women a little bit. You know, it's like, I'm too nice.
Yeah, see,
like,
that's upside down. You know, like you said, hijacking skepticism. Everything is upside down in America. A skeptic is not a real skeptic, you know, and being nice is a bad thing, and being a bad boy or an asshole is a good thing. It's considered cool and popular.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, getting tattoos is now mainstream in America, whereas before it was only, you know, it was trashy and only, you know, gangsters.
Yeah, no, I said I'm a rebel because I don't get tattoos.
Yeah, it's like if you have a tattoo, you're a conformist now. You're not a rebel. If you don't, then you're a rebel.
Yeah.
But yeah, in most other countries, if you're a nice guy, women appreciate that. I mean, it's not a negative thing. There's no such thing as being too nice. I mean, I have a girlfriend from the Philippines now, and so I spend a lot of time there. And in the Philippines, I mean, there's a lot of poverty and corruption, but the social culture is very simple. If you're nice to everyone, everyone will be nice to you, and it's never a negative to be nice. People like it, appreciate it. They value a person that's nice. And so if you're nice, you're down to earth, you're genuine, you'll feel very accepted in the social cultures overseas. You know, maybe not in every culture, but most cultures. Like my favorite cultures are you know, Eastern Europe, Southern Europe, Russia, South America. A lot of guys go to Brazil, to Rio de Janeiro, and they say it's a paradise down there. It's fun, it's wild, and they never want to come back, because one main difference is that
I met some guys in New York from some Danish gentlemen from New York that were most joyous. I mean, they were there for the anniversary of 9/11. They're some of the most joyous guys I ever met in my life.
So. But you see, the problem in America in terms of dating is that between men and women is that men are open and social toward women. They're nice to women, okay? But women are not open and social toward men. They're kind of guarded and paranoid, and they think that every guy that walks up to them and flirts with them is a creep. you know, but flirting used to be okay. In the early 1980s, flirting was a normal thing, but now it's become a taboo in America. It's become vilified. But you see, in a
right.
good, normal, healthy society, both men and women are social to each other. Like you go to Brazil or Rio de Janeiro or even in Mexico, men are open and social toward women, and women are open and social toward men, and that's the way God intended it to be. That's the natural way. But in America, you don't have that. You have men being open and friendly toward women, but women not being open and friendly toward men.
I've actually noticed that. I mean, you know, just make a simple comment, you know, like
they're paranoid and have cold lies.
A pretty lady poked me. How are you doing? And then you don't get a response. You're like, what? I called you pretty? What? I mean, it's just a comment. Like, you know what I mean? Like, it's nothing. Like, yeah, people get paranoid.
Even if I went to a cashier in the supermarket here and I said, oh, you look very beautiful. I mean, that would be kind of violating and creepy, you know, whereas
mm-hmm.
that would be totally normal and accepted in other countries. Like, you know, in European countries, you can go out and flirt.
We'll compliment each other. That's all it is. I mean, it's nothing more. It's nothing less.
Yeah. Like, for example, in Germany, okay, you know, people don't need dating sites to meet women or to meet men, because when men go to a pub in Germany, the women in the pub want to meet them. They're happy to socialize with them and meet them. So men can socialize with women, and women will socialize with men in the pub, you know. They don't, you know, whereas if you go to a bar in America, you know, there's not that many women there, but everyone will have this defensive posture up. You know, they're not going to be as welcoming towards strangers. You know, the whole process of meeting people in America just is not natural or fluid. And so we don't have a very good social culture because everyone's disconnected. I mean, my neighbors, they might say hi to me or wave to me, but they don't invite me over for dinner or barbecue, you know. You know, and if you go to work for a company in America, your coworkers are not going to invite you out or invite you over, too, you know. It's like people just meet for convenience and then they separate. You know, everyone's in an island. Every man is an island in America. People don't want to get close to you or connect with you. And that's kind of sad, you know, because we need other people. We need a good social relations with other people. We need camaraderie and good friendship.
It's essential.
Everyone needs
it's
that,
essential.
You know. And so, yeah, to be happy, you need, you know, money can only buy you so much happiness. You also need good social relationships with people. But America doesn't provide that. It does not provide a good social life. And, you know, after you graduate from high school, it's like there is no social scene because everyone is just, you know, keeping to themselves and you mind your business, I mind my business, and we don't have any reason to talk to each other. And yeah, there's just no, you know, eye contact and it's just a very disconnected culture. You don't have a sense of connection with people. And that's kind of sad because if you're unhappy and you don't connect with people, have good social relations, you're going to fill your void by going out and consuming, buying junk you don't need, overeating, eating too much pizza. You know, you'll start to fill your emptiness with food and consumerism, and that's just very unhealthy to try to seek happiness that way, you know. But a lot of people don't know what to do, so they seek, you know, they try to find happiness in food, video games, you know, trash culture. I mean, and the culture is in a moral decline too, you know. Back in the 70s and before that, I mean, everything on TV was very wholesome and taught good values and morals, and there were nice characters, nice people on TV that you could emulate. And nowadays, 99% of what's on TV is trash. In the 1950s, they would never let trashy content be on TV, never. You know?
No.
They had standards back then. You know, there was no trashy content allowed on TV. But nowadays, everything is trash. You know, it's most of the TV.
Oh, yeah, I mean,
trash.
The TV was on just here in the background the other night. It was just some reality TV show and just people arguing with each other. And just drama. And,
yeah, and it's not interesting. I mean, I like the TV in the 70s when if you look at the TV shows in the 70s, you'll see that people were down to earth. They looked natural. They looked authentic, you know. The women in the 70s, you know, they believed in women's rights and women's lib, okay? But if you looked at their personality, they were still very feminine. Their voices were feminine. But nowadays, it's like something in the food or the air or the harp or the chemtrails, whatever, have changed the biology of Americans. So nowadays, women in America have this masculine voice. They're very cold, and they have this masculine voice.
There's definitely hormones.
You didn't see
milk.
That before.
We know that much.
Yeah, I don't know what it is. It's something. It's got to be something in the food, you know, because it's not just the culture, you know, because if you look at 1970s, I mean, for example, the three beautiful women on Charlie's Angels, for example, if you look at the three girls on Charlie's Angels in the 70s, they all of them believed in women's lib and they believed in equal rights, okay, which is fine, but none of them acted like men. They were never masculine. They were still feminine, sweet. They were wholesome. They were ladylike. And people in the 70s just had this natural, wholesome look. And in the 60s, you know, their faces were wholesome. They had this innocence. There was this innocent look on people that has been lost. You know, you don't see that innocent look anymore in America, in modern America. I don't know if you've noticed that, you know, but just if you look at the TV shows from the past and compare them to now, you'll see this, you know. This huge difference.
Yeah, well, I
have you noticed this on TV? Or?
I can tell you that much.
Have you noticed this when watching TV
shows
from the 70s and comparing them to today? Or?
Yeah, I mean, if you think about, like, a Three's Company and things like that,
I like Three's Company. If you know, Three's Company was funny, but it wasn't trashy, you know? I mean... It looks so natural, you know, compared to the comedy today.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it still has some class.
Yeah,
know,
I mean, it was supposedly controversial, but, I mean, compared to today, it's nothing, you know.
Yeah, it was off-color, you know. I mean, there was a lot of off-color humor, but it wasn't trashy, and the people were not trashy. You know, they were, you know.
Yeah.
But the 80s is when things turned for the worse, you know. I mean, America in 1979 was very different than 1989, you know. It had definitely turned a lot for the worse. And
yeah, that's, I mean, I was born in 81, so, you know, grew up right through it, so.
Oh, you were born in 81. Yeah, you might not remember that very much. You know, if you ask people that, you know, grew up in the 70s, you know, and the 80s, they'll tell you this. I mean, they saw the difference. Very big difference in 79 and 89. Maybe you could ask your parents about that sometime or whatever.
Yeah, definitely.
You know, but you got to ask people that are observing.
I'm sure, you know, people hear this interview, it'll probably spark some conversation. So.
Yeah, very aware and observant.
Oh, definitely.
If you ask the elderly people around the area, they'll tell you that for sure, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
About the moral decline.
And what's the website again? What's the website name?
My other one, it's happierabroad.com. Happier with IER.
Okay.
Abroad.com.
Okay.
And
we have to check that out.
Yeah, I have a lot of content on there about how a person can be a lot happier if they go overseas. And there's a lot of benefits in many areas. It's not just social areas and relationships, but, you know, there's lower cost of living, there's better mental health, there's better, healthier food. So you have all these benefits, economic benefits too, not just social benefits.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of, so I outline about five major areas of life that can be improved by going overseas and finding a culture that fits your personality and fits your lifestyle, you know.
Well, you said you.
It's just something
that,
to consider, you know. Not
these movements have been hesitant to look at it and talk about it. I definitely won't be. I will look into it, and I will definitely promote anything that I see of substance there, and I expect that I will.
Yeah, I'll definitely send you a few video clips so you can see. You don't have to take my word for it. You can see how different people overseas are. I mean, when I show you the video clips,
mm-hmm.
and you can see how much natural people act. from a couple of video clips,
right.
And I have a lot of them. I can send you, and you know, and they'll only be a few minutes long or so. But yeah, this is not talked about even in the conspiracy movement or the alternative media. They don't see this as a solution. So I think I'm the only person in the conspiracy movement that promotes this idea that, you know, you can solve all the problems in America not by staying in America, but by leaving it.
By leaving.
Yeah. Get all
well,
the thinking.
Hey,
tips,
you might
know?
Count me in because I was already thinking this before I talked to you. So.
Yeah, if you stay here,
yeah,
you're just
no,
a slave.
Definitely.
You know?
I'll look at it.
You're
I'll
a slave psychologically.
Videos,
and if you stay here, you're a slave to money. You're a slave psychologically. You're a slave because we live in a fear-based society where everyone's afraid, you know. Everywhere you go, there's all this fear, and it's not healthy. It's not natural. It's not good for you to be in this energy field full of fear and tension and paranoia. That's not normal. It's not natural. When you go overseas, you'll realize that. People don't have to be that way. You know, it just puts you at a very low vibration, you know. If you're constantly living in fear, you're going to be weak, and you're going to be very tired and very...
Yeah, I think that's how they want people to be.
You're just not going to have the energy to do much, you know. Yeah, it's easy to control you, you know, if you're living in fear, you know, so...
Oh, yeah.
They want you to live in fear, and so they can divide you. And, but yeah. If you see my video clips, you'll see what I mean. People who don't live in fear are very, very different type. People. They act.
Yeah, send them along, and when we post this interview, I'll put them up there with it, and put your websites up there and everything. So.
And I know not everybody can.
Going on.
Not everyone can just go overseas,
you know,
okay? Not everybody can just go overseas and just move or something or live. But, you know, it's something to consider, you know. Obviously, you would have to sever your ties in America. You'd have to cut off a lot of responsibilities. You'd have to, you know, you'd have to simplify your life to make it more mobile.
Right.
You know, if you have a house and a job here, it's hard to get rid of all that. You have to simplify your life. And make it more mobile. I mean, a lot of people have done it. It's not
sometimes
easy, but
things
people
are only as hard as you make them, you know. I mean, you literally.
Yeah, a lot of the obstacles are in your mind. A lot of the obstacles are
in
your mind, you know. It's not, they're not in real, but
mm-hmm.
a lot of people, you know, there are millions of Americans that live overseas, so it's definitely possible, but it's not easy, you know. It depends on how many obligations you have in America.
Right.
You know, and how if you're good at simplifying your life with few attachments. So it's definitely something to consider.
Yeah,
like I said, if a ship is sinking, I mean, you don't stay on, you get off. It makes
you
sense.
Don't stay on it, yeah.
So why is no one talking about it?
I completely agree, and I can't wait to look at the material. I think we're going to go ahead and wrap things up for today. Appreciate you being on the show, and I think it was a good
first go at it here.
And
we talked about a lot of topics. I hope you know anyone who listens will be able to hold their attention on so many topics jumping around.
Yeah, I hope we weren't too all over the place, but you know that's what an open mind does. You know, it's the skeptic that's rigid and is going to be this is the way it is and that's it. You know, thinking things out, you know, when you allow your mind to wander, that's when you'll, you know, not be stuck in the black or white area. You'll get to those gray areas. And
yeah. Well, I'm an eclectic person, so I have a lot of interest.
The truth is most of the time, right? We're in the middle. It's the closest place we can be to it. So, you know,
Yeah, truth tends to be in the middle, and reality tends to be shades of gray, not black and white.
Yeah, right.
That's what we have to remember.
At least as close as we can get to. I mean, in reality, it really is one way or the other. But, I mean, you know, I'd rather be leaning towards something. You get what I'm saying? Like, I don't want to be too polarized either way and keep my mind open and be flexible and...
Yeah.
And even like when we talked about, you know, subjects like, you know, multiverses and things like that, those are areas that in reality they are gray. Period. They're not.
Well, yeah, that's very subjective.
You know,
when you deal with non-physical reality, it's very subjective.
Yeah,
of course.
Yeah. All right. Well, I appreciate you being on the show, and I will definitely try to talk to you again sometime, and we'll see if we can't keep this podcast going.
Yeah, we'll see
what
we can do in the future, and maybe we can collaborate on something.
Sounds
you know,
good.
I'll explain more to you later about that, yeah.
Sure. All right. Well, Winston Wu, debunkingskeptics.com, happierabroad.com. Very glad to have you on the show today, sir.
Okay. Do I need to hang up for it to record, or can you just press the stop button? Or?
No, I can hang up.
I can stay on for a little longer if you just want to press the stop button, but... Yeah.